Hey listeners, Shrill Collective here. Just a heads up that The Rat King contains adult content, including descriptions and instances of stalking and violence. Listener discretion is advised. Resources for these issues can be found in the show notes and at the end of the episode. Please enjoy The Rat King.
Welcome, everybody. This is The Rat King. Part 3. A pivotal moment.
Sort of. What's that they're singing?
Hold on, I'm going closer.
Could you hear that?
Those are your kids?
Yeah.
Maybe it's their high voices, but it feels a little...
horror movie.
Yeah. A little Children of the Corn? Yeah.
Oh, I totally agree. Sometimes I hear them in the other room and I imagine them holding little pitchforks. Anyway, here I'm going somewhere quiet.
Okay, just a brief catch-up. The flies are gone, and Daphne, for the most part, recovers from her violent role in their devastation. She doesn't hear anything else from Phoebus for a while. Then, at the end of 2011, she gets another letter, still addressed to Ellie's parents. Dear baby, you and Ellie still kick it? I'll send one to your rents if you don't write back. Peace. Germane to this correspondence, Daphne and Kay immediately get a little water bug issue.
Which is what snobby people call cockroaches. At least when they're in their own houses. The sightings are pretty few and far between, so we were pretty relaxed about it at first. Bijou hunted them, Kay flattened them. I attempted to catch them in jars, but they're really fast. Then I woke up in the middle of the night to, I swear to God, a 2-inch bug walking across the ceiling directly above my head. That was that. Cue fumigation.
Jade, true to form, could not be reached to foot that bill. But after that, the better part of 2012 passes peacefully. All said and done, it's a pretty idyllic time in Daphne's life. She's in her early 30s. She and Kay are very in love, raking in money at their respective nightlife gigs, drinking too much, surrounded by their dearest college friends. Daphne is taking an acting class and writing in her spare time. Kay has a few production jobs lined up, and yeah, Daphne sort of forgets about the letters from Phoebus. Everything seems really pretty okay. Until her grandmother gets colon cancer in the fall of that year. And then, well, I'll let you hear it from Daphne.
So I want to play you something.
Oh, no. Okay.
The following was recorded at a storytelling competition on April 30th, 2013.
Hi, everyone. Blah, my mouth is dry. Okay, so you've probably all noticed it's springtime in New York. I know what you're thinking. Shit. Right? Here comes Mother Nature breaking out all her usual boastful splendor. Naturally makes a gal feel sort of inadequate, but that's okay. I've got some things of my own going on. I'm not trying to gloat, but I got my first stalker. And guys, things are starting to get serious. Okay, fine. He's just a stalker by mail right now, but there's definitely potential. Sometimes you just know. All joking aside, this guy, we dated for almost 3 months, 14 years ago. Truly. Yeah, that's accurate. I mean, I knew I was good, but... The first letters came to my friend's parents in Baltimore, and now they come to my parents in Asheville, which are both places I was known to be. Also 14 years ago. So I guess he's kind of a lazy stalker. I mean, I get it. I'm sure he's got lots of other things on his plate, like my old hairbrush. And addresses are hard.
It's so weird hearing that.
You're funny. You never listen to it back?
Bleh, never.
Well, I have to say, you seem fearless.
Yeah, I was and I wasn't. I mean, I think I wrote that monologue as a kind of exorcism.
Put it in your art?
Something like that.
I noticed you used his real name in the performance.
Yeah.
And you do call him a stalker.
By mail. I remember feeling like I needed to clarify that.
My mom forwarded me a letter from back in October. This was the same week the doctors found cancer in my grandmother's colon. They gave her a pretty good prognosis. His letter was from a county jail in the Northwest, so yeah. He wanted to know what I'd been up to for the last decade. You know, if I was married. Nope, but might as well be. Or had kids. And nope. Didn't bother to ask if I was interested in hearing from him. Or even straight. Another letter arrived in January. This one seemed a little... How can I say this nicely? I can't. He quoted The Goonies. You know, it's our time down here. And said he wanted to take me on a walk in the forest. Which, I don't know. I'm normally pretty outdoorsy. Maybe it's me, I don't know. In mid-March, my grandmother's pretty good prognosis became an accelerated decline. Funny how that just happens. Two more letters arrived during that time. I didn't bother to read them. We had a lot going on. It wasn't until after the funeral, when I got back to the city, that I finally gave them a read. They were much longer than the others, and wow. I mean, the frantic, childlike handwriting was a psychological masterpiece in itself. I was his Valentine, sweet. There was no one in the world like me, accusatory. He was getting released from jail May 1st. That line I read a few times. Yeah, that's very soon. Very soon. Between quotes by Bob Marley and William Shatner, Ken mused on whether he should go to my parents' house in Asheville or come straight to New York, where he'd finally surmised I was living. I think with the aid of my abandoned MySpace page. Thank you, MySpace.
Is the chronology of the monologue accurate?
It is.
So, over the course of 6-ish months, he sends you 4 letters, and they all now go to your parents.
Yes.
Do they think you should do something?
Like I say in the monologue, we had a lot going on during that period. It's not like when this sort of thing starts happening to you, you get to drop everything and indulge it full time. You deal with it in the cracks. And I was home to support my mom through the death of her mom and to grieve. So that's what we were thinking about. And honestly, the whole question of what to do was pretty paralyzing. At one point, I did take a stroll to the local police precinct.
In Brooklyn? What do they say?
I spoke to a female officer. I felt like an insane person trying to explain the situation. He's following you? No, sending letters. To your residence? No, to a different state. Like, it was excruciating. Ultimately, she told me there was nothing they could do about that because the letters weren't coming to New York, and to come back if he showed up.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know what I expected. A force field around my house, maybe?
A little sensitivity?
Maybe.
He wanted to know why I wasn't responding. What was I doing? Who did I think I was? I sat there for a long time. Outside my window, a visibly pregnant rat was searching around the misfit lid of the trash can, looking for a way in, which, of course, she found. Good for her. So, I don't know. What do you think? Maybe I finally have to admit that I have a real problem with... It kind of pisses me off. You want to know why I'm not responding? We knew each other 14 years ago, you narcissistic piece of garbage. What am I doing that's so important? I'm putting my grandmother in the ground. Who do I think I am? Another letter arrived last week. I haven't opened it. I just leave it around the apartment in various places like a bill I can't afford to pay. Which I guess isn't totally inaccurate. So, yeah. Spring in New York City. Tomorrow is the 1st of May. May Day, May Day. Oh, the plans we'll make.
How is that?
Sort of mixed, honestly. It's good to hear myself sound in command. It's such an illusion. I never feel that way.
It seems like by this point, you're beginning to realize that Phoebus is a real problem. And more than that, you're pretty angry about it.
Yeah, but still, I created a pretty detached persona, a lot of comedy. It's interesting. After that performance, I just went home and watched TV. Like, that was enough. I said it. Now everyone go away. And Kay was really proud of me. I just remember looking at them and saying, for what? I didn't do anything.
They were proud of you for taking the reins of your fear.
I know, but I'd entered this strange self-loathing. Here I was, this empowered woman living in New York, but I was just a ball of equivocation and denial. I felt overwhelmed.
Do you seek any kind of professional counsel?
Not therapy or anything, but I guess it was around then I called my angel guide.
You're what?
Angel guide.
Obviously, I need to pause and ask you what that means.
She communicates to my guardian angel and then conveys their messaging back to me.
Pretty straightforward if you're into that kind of thing.
I laid out everything, all the apparent options. Like, should I contact his attorney, hire a private investigator, ignore the problem, engage his family? I don't know what I expected to hear. Maybe I was just hoping my angel would wave a wand.
So they can't do that?
No, they're not like the fairy godmother. Unfortunately.
So what's the take?
Basically, that when I resolved my own energetic dilemmas, Phoebus would leave me alone. It was like spiritual victim blaming. You know, if she wasn't interested in him, she should have done a better job transcending him.
If you weren't wearing your karma like that.
Yeah, right.
Okay, I see that is not what you were looking for.
I didn't even know what I was looking for. I was totally spinning. There weren't any perfect answers. I was basically dealing with the unknown. I was concerned about getting him in trouble, like messing with his sentence, provoking him, and I didn't want to fuel his obsession by responding to him. I guess I ultimately decided to do nothing. I hoped to starve him. It's upsetting to think about because now I see that time as a really crucial period in this entire saga. This is when he was sussing me out, like testing my boundaries. It was actually a pivotal moment.
That phrase strikes me. Pivotal moment. Merriam-Webster defines it two ways. One, of relating to or constituting a pivot. And two, vitally important. Both versions of the definition feel so accurate to the situation with Phoebus. This is a vitally important moment when Daphne needs to pivot. But she is, in her words, paralyzed. There is absolutely no way for Daphne to assess the level of threat Phoebus poses without exposing herself further. Maybe taking some kind of action might have provoked Phoebus to try harder, gnaw through her barriers, as Daphne fears. Or maybe he would be effectively deterred and find a different habitat for his delusion. But rats will view inaction as an invitation, and Phoebus might be the same. And he might not need any crumbs from Daphne. His imagination of her is rich and more fruitful than anything the real Daphne can offer. I think of the whole Mayday, Mayday joke. She really is asking for help, whether she knows it or not. But no one is listening.
Thinking about that monologue, you're dancing around the theme of rodents, the visibly pregnant rat. You're weaving rats together with Phoebus, even then. It's pretty eerie.
Yeah. I guess I already sensed some connection there. When you're infested, you're infested. It permeates every division. It's systemic. It's conscious and subconscious. The infestation is the driver, and the driver has control.
So let's talk about that. The infestation and Phoebus as dual antagonists. While these letters from Phoebus are picking up steam, the rat situation outside Daphne's front gate is also getting out of control. Another funny detail in Daphne's monologue that catches my ear. Misfit lid of the trash can outside her window. Now, if you walk around most neighborhoods of Brooklyn, you'll see a lot of houses have some kind of garbage shed in front for the precise purpose of keeping rats out. In fact, all the houses within eyeshot of Daphne's apartment have these sorts of sheds. Resin ones, wooden ones. And if you're thinking my reason for mentioning this is that Daphne's apartment building does not have such a shed, then you're right. As Daphne explains it, the situation with the trash at her apartment is such that not only is there no shed, but there aren't even any lids on the bins most of the time.
Because the lids are mismatched and don't fit properly, so they get knocked off.
By, you guessed it, rats. Yes, the neighborhood rats have one clear path of least resistance to their prize, and they take it as a kind of free-for-all. I mean, if you were a rat, wouldn't you?
The trash was right outside our front window. We couldn't ignore it, so we sort of took it upon ourselves to drag the cans out to the street on collection days and whatever. It didn't seem like anyone else was going to.
Here, Daphne is referring to the strange, insinuated condition Jade leaves hanging in the air between them that first meeting. Jade's high, girlish whine, as dimensionless as the sound of a pebble on an aluminum can. That's fabulous. I like people that do things themselves.
It was a weird dynamic, I know. But honestly, there was a kind of benefit to Jade's dereliction of duty. She really left us alone, which we liked. My friends had some very overbearing landlords before, especially in Brooklyn. But we also knew managing the trash for all four units was a totally unacceptable expectation of us, so we didn't go too far out of our way.
Okay. Forgive me for being reductive, but your attitude is yay to dragging the trash to the street, nay to replacing the bins or the lids.
We weren't going to spend any actual money.
And so by spring 2013, by the time Daphne performs at that storytelling competition, she and Kay are already in a little bit of trouble when it came to the rats. Of course, it isn't just Daphne and Kay that have to deal with them. It is their neighbors on either side as well. And one in particular is starting to get, well, pissed. Remember Eloise or Esther?
So Eloise or Esther, her stoop was very tidy. And I'd peeked over at her backyard before. She kept things like prescriptively landscaped. Her vibe was like something from that Tupperware episode of Eerie, Indiana.
Is that where they sleep in giant Tupperware?
Yes. Yes. Wow. I'm glad you've seen that. No one ever knows what I'm talking about. Okay. Anyway, so you can sort of imagine who I was dealing with.
Esther appears at Daphne's gate one morning. This is their first face-to-face. Daphne is groggy, having worked late the night before. She says she quickly takes in Eloise's visual information, as much as she can while betraying no effort to do so.
She was completely white. All over. From her close-cropped hair to her pristine fleece jacket. She had those expensive urban walking shoes that you see a lot on older wealthy Brooklynites. And everything was like an eggshell or a desert taupe.
I heart Daphne in her colors.
And she just didn't say anything at all. She just stood there. So I waited. I've studied humans enough to recognize when they're leveraging power. Chalk it up to my many years of service industry jobs.
And here's just another customer.
Right. Exactly. So Esther waited and measured me, and I waited and allowed Esther to measure me. She finally said, "You have a rat problem."
You, personally.
That felt like the implication. And then she said, "Something needs to be done with this area." And she sort of waved her hand at an area that seemed generally to include me.
Admittedly, the area also includes 2 30-gallon garbage bins and 2 recycling bins, and all 4 receptacles are currently exploding with an excess of trash and packaging, mostly from Presley, who Daphne remembers as an arrogant 20-something who orders everything delivered, from furniture to carryout, and disposes of his waste with the carelessness of a high-ranking officer's army brat, which he was. Besides Daphne's earnest efforts to control the area, it is a disgraceful display.
But I couldn't concede to this woman. I just couldn't. I know she was finding droppings outside her door, and they were starting to drag food over there and eat it. I'd seen it happen, so yeah, not ideal, right? Awful, actually. Of course she was in the right, but I just couldn't stand how she was being.
So what happens?
She said, "Well, maybe it doesn't bother you enough, but it sure bothers me. Maybe someday it'll bother you too."
Creepy.
Just like that. Yeah. And very soon after that, I found a dead rat outside my gate. Just sort of laid there. And while Kay and I were disposing of it, well, they were disposing of it, I was standing there trying not to puke. I saw some movement behind Esther's curtain, and I caught her watching us. I just felt ice in my spine.
Wait, do you think she left it there?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
At this point, Daphne does attempt to contact Jade, but the number is disconnected. She even takes a step she would normally avoid. She talks to her upstairs neighbors to find out if they know Jade's whereabouts. She remembers when she tells Vic about the problem with Eloise, he can barely contain his glee at the adversity Daphne is facing.
I mean, we did try to get rid of the rats on our own. We sprayed peppermint extract and scattered Bijou's used litter around the trash cans.
Suffice to say, their nature baby efforts go nowhere. It's too little, too late. The rats are at home. And Daphne is now fielding daily harassment from Esther, or Eloise, who at least, thankfully, refrains from leaving any more dead rats.
Then Kay got a production job on a movie that was shooting for 6 weeks in Atlanta, so they left mid-May, and honestly, I just kind of gave up.
But the rats don't, and Daphne starts having a lot of interaction with them. She still works at a busy night spot downtown. Super sceney, high volume, high checks, a lot of grotesque wealth.
Very last days of the Roman Empire kind of vibe. I mean, you just go into this fugue state during those shifts. It's nonstop. Then by the end, you're kind of reeling. I'd come home by taxi usually 3 or 4 in the morning. There'd be like 10 or 15 rats hanging around the trash cans. And they'd run under the gate when I got close.
Wait, under your gate?
Yeah, but just the exterior iron gate. Then there was a very small outdoor vestibule under the front stairs of the brownstone. On one side, there was a little wooden door with a latch, which led to the space under the stoop. They usually ran under that, so I'd just slip into my door.
So, just to clarify, you get out of a cab, walk to your apartment, and then basically follow a group of 10 or 15 rats inside the vestibule?
Basically, I'd shake my keys and then kick the gate as I opened it. And sometimes I'd hear them scatter back under the stairs, you know, behind the wooden door. Then one night I stepped on one of those wobbly slates.
Remember those loose pavers Daphne had noticed when she first viewed the apartment?
And I heard a scream.
A rat scream?
Yes.
In case you don't know what that sounds like, one more time.
I looked down and there was about 3 inches of a rat tail sticking out under my foot. I jumped back and the rest of the tail disappeared under the paver. Then I went inside and threw up.
So Daphne can now say with some certainty that the rats are nesting there. And why not? There is an endless source of food handy just feet away. The property is very poorly managed. The tenants have proven ill-equipped or disinterested in putting up any real resistance. It's a promising spot. So the rats post up there. And with authority. And this is what Daphne now has to contend with.
It just seems like a really uncomfortable way to live.
Yeah, I was basically starting to lose it.
Meanwhile, true to promise, in a galaxy far, far away, Phoebus is released from jail. As if psychically galvanized by Daphne's snarky accusation that he is a lazy stalker, he immediately gets hold of her cell number and begins contacting her directly for the first time. Her display usually shows a 503 area code, or says blocked, or sometimes unknown. And don't forget, Kay is in Atlanta at this time, so Daphne's feeling pretty freaked out.
First thing he did was text me. That came from the 503 area code.
What does that say?
Happy sunrise. And he signed it like a letter. Love, comma, and then his name.
That's it?
That's it. Just happy sunrise. He's said and written many creepy things since, but that was still the scariest text I've ever gotten from him.
Why is that?
So many reasons. One, and I guess most obviously, he'd breached another boundary, you know, by having my private number. Two, I received the text at 5:39 a.m. That was the exact time the sun rose that day on the East Coast. I checked. And it would have been 2:39 in the morning for him if he was in Oregon, so the text asserted a proximity to me, you know, whether he was physically or psychologically aligning himself with me. Either version freaked me out.
Is there a three?
Oh, yeah, three. Happy sunrise. Sunrise is the beginning. The dawn. It felt like he was saying we were just getting started. I know this wouldn't have changed anything, really, but I always regret that I didn't think to change my voice message right when I got that text. It said, hey, this is Daphne, leave a message. So the first time he called, which was later that same day, I panicked and forwarded him to voicemail. And he didn't leave a message, but he would have heard my voice. I immediately changed it after that to the generic outgoing message, but I hated that. I hated that I let him have that morsel.
Hey, hit me up. This is my cell. Yo, me and Jay are gonna float this weekend. Call me. I wanna hear from you. Daphne. Nah, just playing. Daphne. Okay. Peace.
Float?
River raft, I think. That's a big thing out there.
Yo, Lost my phone last night. So this is my dad's number. I'm not staying here. Yeah. What are you looking at? My dad's looking at me. Okay, talk to you soon. I love you. Daffy Duck. Come on, man. Call me back. And cell phones, man. Okay, love you.
Does he say his cell phone is mint?
Yeah. Yeah. And notice he started saying, I love you. Just slid it right in there.
At the behest of Kay, who is threatening to leave the set in Atlanta and come home, Daphne does finally call someone for help, a family friend. And with Daphne's permission, I talk to that someone as well.
I have 10 minutes, literally 10. I'm saying that in advance so you know I'm not being rude when I have to hang up on you in the middle of a sentence.
This is Janine, known affectionately to her colleagues as Nibby. We won't be using her last name, or anyone's going forward, in order to protect the privacy of the people involved in this story. She's been a criminal defense attorney in New York City for nearly 20 years. So she's actually more likely to defend a stalker than prosecute one, and she has done that. But this gives her unique perspective, and she definitely doesn't equivocate when it comes to Phoebus's threat.
Out of the gate, I wanted Daphne to know that what was happening was not okay. And my real goal, which I obviously failed at, was getting her to assert herself, put up a roadblock, enforce clear boundaries, and do it on the record.
What does that look like?
It could look many ways. None of them are perfect, and none of them are guaranteed. I was hoping Daphne would allow me to draft a formal letter, advising a stalker that his contact is unwanted and will not be tolerated further. This letter would also go to his attorney, so there would be a reliable record of its receipt.
You characterize him as a stalker.
Why wouldn't I?
Apparently, some people don't think this qualifies.
Of course it qualifies. Don't be ridiculous.
I have to say, with all the gray area and wishy-washy, pardon me, bullshit victims and survivors have to contend with, it's refreshing to get these lashes from Nibby.
We did take some steps, anonymously, of course, to secure court documents from the Multnomah County Courthouse. This provided better understanding of the crimes Daphne Stalker committed to get himself incarcerated in the first place. There was an assault charge, not sexually motivated, and a breaking and entering charge and a robbery charge. We considered a private investigator to determine more, but that can be very costly, and this was as far as Daphne wanted to take it at the time.
Did you understand that decision?
Of course. Would I have made a different determination? Probably. But I understand all of the feelings. It's all valid. These situations are insidious. They take hold of you in a very specific way, sneak right in wherever there's a hole in your defenses. And there aren't any clear remedies. No risk-free road to absolution. I've had 3 stalkers myself, so I know.
I'm sorry.
They should be sorry. And I know for a fact one of them is. It's them that should be sorry. And sister, we could all stand to be a little less sorry.
And it's true. And it's terrible. People that live through harassment, stalking, and even assault are constantly asked to examine and re-examine their own culpability. What would make someone do this to you? And this even extends to how they choose to manage their situations. Why didn't you do something? Or if they do take action, why didn't you do something sooner or different?
Hello, yo. I think I saw you at that party though. I know you saw me. If you fucked up, it's okay. Yo, Daphne. Okay, I love you. Hit me back.
What party?
No idea.
Not you?
Nope.
Daphne saves all of them, all the messages. and she begins compiling a little notebook with the time and date of every single call and text.
At this point, I was feeling stuck. I had Nibby's advice of contacting his attorney, but I was worried it would enrage him.
What does Kay say?
I can tell they're worried, but they just keep encouraging me to do what I think or what I feel, which I know is technically respectful, but not
helpful.
Yeah. So I'm not sleeping well. And then around 5:30 a.m. on June 23rd, 2013.
Is that?
Yep, you guessed it, sunrise. I heard this loud bang on my street-facing window. Bijou leapt off the bed and raced to the front of the apartment and started making this terrible, desperate meowing sound.
You were alone?
Yes. Kay was due back from Atlanta in a little over a week. I was legitimately terrified. Bijou was protesting and crying for a really long time before I worked up the nerve to look out there. I don't know what I thought I would find. The mind is so fluid and creative in the morning. I don't remember what I was thinking, just free associating like crazy. Would it be Phoebus or a package from Phoebus or a fallen tree or another dead rat hurled by my neighbor? I finally pulled back the blind, but it wasn't any of those things. It was a little squirrel, a juvenile, small, like the size of my hand. It was just sitting there, totally dazed. It must have run full force into the window because there was a smudge of blood across its nose. It was terrified. I could see its little heart pounding. Bijou was losing her mind, so I put her in the bathroom. I thought it would just get its wits back at some point, but it didn't. I called a local shelter to see if I could bring it in. They said to call Animal Rescue, so I did that, but they said to try a local shelter.
New York.
Yep.
So then what?
Well, as I was considering my next move, I heard something else. Kind of froze my blood. A low hiss and a chittering sound, like... And I saw the rat behind the trash can.
No longer confined to the cover of night, emboldened by Daphne's inaction, brazen in the broad daylight of a summer morning. Daphne says within a second, it starts. Blood sprays against the window, and that rat's fat, gruesome tail thrashes around, painting that same blood across the glass, smacking over and over, making these dull, ghastly thuds as it tosses the squirrel around. Daphne bangs on the window, but the rat doesn't let go. It yanks the squirrel off the ledge and starts pulling it toward the loose pavers.
By the time I got outside, the rat was already dragging the squirrel underground, and for a split second, I swear we just looked at each other. And then it disappeared with its prize. The squirrel was still screaming. Both their screams seemed to be harmonizing in the most chilling song.
What happens next?
I pulled up the slab. And another, and another. I lost two fingernails in the process.
Ooh, ouch.
I kept digging until my hands were raw. But I was finally seeing it. All the damage they'd done over weeks and months and years. How the gravel was loose and the ground was shifting and unstable. I saw the network of roadways and tunnels they'd constructed under our noses. It was almost like we were just maybe days away from the ground giving way and swallowing us up completely. Not really, but, you know.
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
We'd been wrong and foolish. This wasn't our building or our street or our city. It was theirs.
But Daphne doesn't feel scared. For some reason, she isn't scared at all. She's lucid.
Facing all that, for the first time in a while, I knew just what I needed to do and where I needed to go. And it was down.
The Rat King is a production of The Shrill Collective. It was written by L.R. Wilde, directed by Chelsea Feltman and Ash Croce. Audio engineering and sound design by Brando Kress. Production assistance by Christina Cole, Allison Wilkes Borland, and Linda DeFuria. Cover art by Samantha Farello. Featuring the voices of Stephanie Lavadera, Kelly Grego, Daniel Van Thomas, Fernando Vieira, Karen Levan, Richard Fisher, Dina Laura, Cherie Wishard, Al Pagano, and Rachel Feltman. The music was written, recorded, and arranged by Chelsea Feltman, Brando Kress, and Tim Leonard. Special thanks to Tim Leonard, Wes Borland, Max Zimbert, Monique Morgan, Laura Annister Walters, Maureen and Robert Croce, Rachel Feltman, Tessa Fay, and Tay Birch. If you or someone you know is being stalked, or is a survivor of domestic or sexual abuse, help is available. Go to stalkingawareness.com for victim resources and information. This and other information is linked in the show notes.